From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part five in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order seen from contemporary and historical standpoints. The discussion at hand focuses on the research of one scholar who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center. He is Jerome Handler of Southern Illinois University. The title of Professor Handler's study is Africans and Their Descendants in Barbados, a book which deals with the social and cultural life of a West Indian slave population in the 200-year period spanning the early 17th through the early 19th centuries. What was slave life in Barbados like? What cultural elements did the slaves of Barbados bring with them from Africa? And how were these transformed in the New World? The conversation with Professor Handler begins with comments on how his interest in cultural anthropology in Barbados changed from a contemporary to an historical viewpoint.
In the course of doing the research in this village, which was conventional social anthropological research, I was interested in plantation workers, all of whom were descendants of slaves, and how their agricultural and other work activities affected their community organization, their family and household life, and so on. I began doing some historical research to try to find out something about the antecedents of these people. And in the process of working with the kinds of materials that historians normally work with, printed materials, old books, manuscripts, it dawned on me that what I had really been interested in was the period at which these vast migrations had taken place, the period during which thousands upon thousands of people were transported across from Africa and transported to a very, very different kind of environment in the New World.
Now, you're talking about the 17th and the 18th centuries.
That's right. That's right. It dawned on me that it was less the contemporary situation that I was interested in than the historical period, the period at which these Africans came to the New World, the period during which they created new kinds of behavioral and cultural systems. And so the interest in Africa that had initially stimulated me when I was an undergraduate took a full swing, and ultimately I ended up being very, very concerned with the historical period, the period at which all of these what I call forced immigrants, came to the New World. And I began to develop a research project using Barbados as the site of this project, a project that was devoted to trying to explore the processes by which African immigrants to the New World lost, modified, or retained their cultural heritages under the conditions of slavery. I chose Barbados for several reasons. For one, it was an island in which I had done anthropological fieldwork, so I had a contemporary perspective from which to view problems in the island's history. I could envision the island. I knew the people. I knew the descendants of slaves. All the kinds of things, an awareness and sensitivity to the contemporary situation that I hope would make me sensitive to the historical one. Secondly, Barbados, which is a little backwater island today and known primarily to relatively wealthy tourists or people who can afford to take package tours to the island, Barbados lies in the Southern Caribbean. It's well known for its rum and its gorgeous beaches. It's a very pretty island, not dramatically beautiful, but very pleasantly pretty. Today, known as a tourist resort, in the 17th century, it was the wealthiest of England's colonies in the New World. By the end of the 17th century, that is by about 1700 or so, Barbados was worth more to the English overseas empire than all of the mainland continental colonies combined. And the reason for this incredible importance of the island and its unbelievable wealth for that period of time was, of course, the growth of sugar on a commercial scale, sugar grown on plantations with the labor of countless thousands of Africans, people of African descent or African origin.
What was life like for these people? If you were to pick, for instance, a relatively short historical span that would illustrate the kind of lives that these slaves, the slave population, led.
Well, life was very grim, but that's the problem of this research project initially, Wayne, is to try to find out what that life was like, okay? And since the materials that I'm dealing with are by and large written materials, these were not written by the slaves themselves. That is to say, I'm trying to find out what the way of life of these slaves was like through primarily the written documents of 17th and 18th century Europeans who themselves were highly ethnocentric, highly racist, who viewed Africans from a very, very negative point of view, who were innocently oftentimes naive of African behaviors, values, points of view. And so there was an enormous amount of distortion going on. I'm not trying to evade your question. I'm trying to suggest that there are a variety of problems associated with trying to reconstruct the way of life of a population that did not leave written records of its own. Slaves lived in what were in effect villages. And these villages, which may on medium to large size plantations might have approached between 100 and 200 people, on the average a West Indian sugar plantation, though it may not have been larger in terms of area than an American plantation, by and large they had larger slave contingents. So in effect slaves lived in relatively small villages in a number of houses that were in close proximity to one another. The slave village was usually located very close to what was called the main yard, where the plantation owner or manager had his house. And the reasons that the villages were located so close to the plantation owner or manager's house was, of course, questions of security. This way, they were always under the eye. The villages themselves, one could tell, were very small. Houses were close to one another. Infectious and contagious diseases spread very rapidly. The houses were by and large flimsy in the earlier periods, very vulnerable to fire, to destruction by winds and storms, and so on. Not far from the village would be located the pond, or the ponds, from which the slaves drew their major water supply, and a water supply that they usually shared with the plantation's cattle. And then not far from the water supply, you would have the burial ground. So, in effect, the central part of a sugar plantation would be composed of the yard area where the owner or manager's house was, and not far from that would be the stables, other kinds of outbuildings, the cooper's shop, the sugar mill, all the kinds of equipment used in the manufacture of sugar. Not far from that would be the slave village. Located close to the village would be the pond or the ponds, and then the slave burial ground. Now, the daily life of the slaves varied somewhat, but not significantly different in a profoundly significant way in terms of the daily round of activities than what one finds in sugar plantation villages today in more traditional areas of the West Indies. The contours of that life would vary by the crop season itself. That is, in the growth of sugar, there are essentially two times, two broad seasons. In the English-speaking Caribbean, one season when the sugarcane is harvested is called the crop season, and the other season when the sugarcane is not harvested is called the dead season, in the Spanish islands known as tiempo muerto, where other things are going on. Now, during that part of the year when sugar was not being harvested, plantation slaves were doing any number of things, dealing primarily with agricultural work. Fields were being prepared, food crops were being planted. Work was generally conducted, normally at least 8 or 9 hours a day, under usually very, very hot, sunny conditions. When they came back to their quarters at night, one just has to assume what went on. People were tired. They were compelled to cook their own meals quite often. They might have told stories. They sat around and relaxed, smoking tobacco. Tobacco was often given to slaves as kind of a reward, as a treat, as an incentive to conform to plantation disciplinary norms. Mothers would talk to their children. We don't know anything about this in detail. One has to speculate on a whole way of life that was going on. People would have ailments. They would be cured, we know. Each plantation village would have at least one, maybe several people who were known as obeah men or obeah women. These were folk doctors, oftentimes using magical cures to help cure people of any number of ailments, sickness, disease, and so on that they had. This was a very poor population, a highly malnourished population, living in an age clearly in which people didn't have the benefits of modern medicine. And under those kind of conditions, not unlike European societies at the time, folk doctors, folk healing practices were extraordinarily important. So that within the plantation slave village, quite often, the person who might have been the most important person was this Obeah man or the so-called Negro doctor, as he or she might have been called in the 17th and 18th century, a person who possessed all kinds of talents, magical and otherwise, for curing people of physical and mental ailments. This kind of curing would go on then at night when people got home from work. The normal routine of the plantation slave was working from sunup to sundown. The hours were very long. Quite often they would get maybe an hour or two off for so-called breakfast, what we could call lunch, during the hot time of the day when the sun was very, very high. The days were repetitive. The agricultural cycle endlessly renewed itself. The tasks were not tasks which required vast technical skills for the mass of the slaves who were called field laborers, right? Field laborers were normally divided into two large groups. The more physically robust younger people would be the first gang. People who were less robust physically, older people, would be the second gang. And the first gang performed the bulk of the heavy work on a sugar plantation in the days of slavery. On Sundays, people would be off, generally speaking. And on Sundays, you found a whole new way of life going on when a lot of the most important social activities of the slaves took place. On Sundays, people were literally, within limits, free to do what they wanted to do. There were minimal constraints placed upon their behavior. So on Sundays, people might sit around their houses, they might repair clothes, they might make baskets, they might go out to the little plots of land that they were allotted by plantations and try to supplement the food that they received from plantations. But the two most important activities that took place on Sundays was, one, the markets, the internal marketing system, and a marketing system that exists today in the Caribbean islands, and one can see it very readily in places such as Jamaica or Haiti. It was in the internal marketing system that slaves would not only distribute goods that they themselves had produced or stolen, but they would also be able to acquire goods that were not provided for them by the plantations themselves. The marketing system was a system of great intricacy. It's in which a lot of food crops got provided to the urban populations in towns which did not grow their food. It was a time in which slaves from different plantations would come together, would meet under social circumstances, would get to know one another. The markets provided opportunities for all kinds of social interaction, and the image that could come most readily to mind is really an African or a West Indian market today. The other major thing which might have occurred within the marketplaces itself, or it need not have been, but was of major importance to the slaves, was the Sunday dance. And music, as with their African ancestors, was an extraordinarily important dimension of slave life. Africa has an enormously rich tradition in music, music which occurs not only in secular, but also within religious contexts. Slaves not only employed work songs to help facilitate the arduous, tedious labor they performed in the sugar plantations, but also music was very important as a form of relaxation. Music accompanied by African instrumentation. For even though instruments such as the drums were banned in many parts of the New World, they persisted to an enormous degree. It was at these Sunday dances that slaves not only danced. This was a time of festivity, it was a holiday, but it was also a time, once again, for people from different plantations to get together. Social interaction of all kinds occurred. Men met women, boys met girls, a lot of gambling went on, cockfighting, drinking, another form of relaxation, and so on and so forth. Now, with these Sunday dances, though they raised a specter quite often of the planters of great suspicion and great unease, because planters, whites in general, were always very uneasy when large groups of slaves would gather under seemingly uncontrolled conditions. But the planters never would have tampered in any profound degree with trying to eliminate these Sunday dances.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to Part 5 in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order seen from contemporary and historical perspectives. My guest is Jerome Handler of Southern Illinois University, who recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where Professor Handler worked on a book entitled Africans and Their Descendants in Barbados. Professor Handler's study examines the cultural and social life of the slave population of Barbados during the 200-year period between the early 17th through the early 19th centuries.
One of the ideal objectives of any anthropologist, regardless of where he or she works, one of the objectives is to try to see the world, try to adopt the perspective of the people among whom you are living, who you are learning about. I find this, as a white American of the 20th century, increasingly difficult. I can say certain things about the slaves, let's say, but I don't know if I can ever be absolutely sure about what went on during this period of history.
Well, are you selling yourself short here, or how do you get this conviction or this doubt?
Well, maybe in a way I'm selling myself short, and maybe in another way I'm just increasingly frustrated at the constraints placed upon me by the kinds of materials that I'm dealing with. I don't have one account. I don't have a contemporary observer who sat down and wrote for me an extensive, dispassionate, objective description. What I have are bits and pieces of information scattered through any number of different kinds of sources, from old letters to old printed books or what have you. Someone may have written something, a little sentence in 1675. Someone else may have written some other sentence in 1703. And from these little bits and patches of information, I'm trying to construct what a slave village might have looked like simply in its physical features. The analogy that comes most readily to my mind is trying to do a jigsaw puzzle in which you don't have all the pieces. You don't know how many pieces there are. The pieces that you have, which may have different colors to them, you're not sure if one goes to the sky or one goes to the grass. You don't have that picture in front of you to guide you. And so what you build up on the basis of maybe what I know about contemporary villages in the West Indies or Africa, what I try to build up is a picture of what a village might have looked like. Now, this, with a lot of gaps and holes in it, facing this constant gap in information, and this was particularly the case, let's say, in trying to describe a slave plantation, it occurred to me one day that I had gone pretty much as far as all the historical records would permit me to go in trying to acquire information. And perhaps now I could use a different methodology in approaching slave life, something that was perhaps a little more objective, that might introduce a fresh perspective on things, a perspective that I was no longer getting because of immersal in the accounts of 17th and 18th century Englishmen and Scotsmen and so on and so forth. And I adopted a methodology that is part of contemporary American anthropology, which is the methodology of archaeology. In this country, most professional anthropologists have some training in archaeology, which, as most people know, is a series, at least on one level, involves a series of techniques whereby excavations in the ground hopefully will yield information about past cultures or societies on the basis of what material remains exist. And it occurred to me that perhaps we could employ archaeology with respect to trying to uncover information about slave life. I would construct a project, as I ultimately did with an archaeological colleague of mine, in which we went to Barbados under the auspices of, among other foundations, the National Science Foundation. And ultimately, we ended up excavating in a major way in a slave cemetery on a very, very old sugar plantation for which there was also extensive historical documentation. So now what we had was an opportunity to investigate slave life through their material remains. Material remains, not only their skeletons, but whatever artifactual materials were placed in the graves. And in a very real sense, the slaves then would be talking directly to us without the intervention of European observers writing down their own perceptions of how slaves behaved and believed. The slaves, clearly in burying their own dead centuries ago, did not anticipate that one day a scholar would be trying to view their behavior, and so there's no reason to suspect that anything artificial was done in all the burials that we uncovered. So archaeology then became a supplementary device in trying to uncover information about how the slaves lived, because clearly when you're exploring the dead, you're actually exploring the living. The dead don't bury themselves. And the slaves, as any African population, for them, the whole mortuary complex, the whole panoply of behaviors and beliefs surrounding death and the afterlife was an extraordinarily crucial feature of their everyday life. But in the early days of slavery on this island, as indeed all over the New World as best as I can gather, the kind of life that slaves developed was very profoundly influenced by their African backgrounds. Mind you, of the maybe 10 million Africans who arrived on the shores of the New World during the some 400 years of the slave trade, nobody knows how many died, and the best estimates are between 8 and 10 million arrived alive. Most of these people arrived, clearly after a very traumatizing experience, and perhaps Alex Haley in his great novel Roots has best expressed the nature of that trauma, something that a scholar I don't think could do. It would take the novelist's imagination. But these people, regardless of the psychological state in which they arrived in the New World, were people who were generally in their late teens and early 20s. That is, they were young adults. They had been socialized in African societies. They had learned the mores, the values, the beliefs of the cultures in which they grew up. They didn't arrive on the shores of the New World with their minds blank, onto which were impressed later on European beliefs, Christianity, and so on and so forth. So in the early days, as slaves from a variety of language backgrounds in Africa got together on plantations, they were interacting with one another, oftentimes not sharing a common language, but sharing broadly based similar beliefs. Now within this, beliefs surrounding an afterlife, religion, broadly speaking, were profoundly important. And within the whole context of religious behavior, the beliefs surrounding the funeral and the afterlife were very, very vital. Now, in most West African societies, people believed very deeply in an afterlife. That is, after death, the soul transmigrated. Usually there was a belief that the soul transmigrated back to the area where one was born. So, for example, if someone died 100 miles away from his natal village, the belief was that ultimately his soul would return to the natal village, okay? Now, there's no reason to expect or to suspect that this very profound belief, which many, many West African people shared, by the way, was a belief that clearly West Africans shared with Europeans, which perhaps made it easier, one of a number of points, broad points, in which African, West African religions and Christianity, for example, were comparable, belief in one God, a belief in the afterlife, the spirit, the soul, and so on and so forth, which made it easier for Africans to convert to Christianity because they didn't have to shed some very important notions in their own traditional belief patterns. Clearly, conditions were extraordinarily harsh, both psychologically and physically, for slaves on West Indian sugar plantations. And clearly also, with a profound conception in the afterlife, one could look forward to a period of time when one would be literally free of the kind of oppression that one was experiencing. And as a footnote to all of this, this, curiously enough, was one of the most fundamental pitches that was made to slaves when planters and the white power authority in particular decided that conversion of slaves would be a good thing, because for many, many years in the English Sugar Islands, unlike the Spanish or the French areas, slaves were not converted to Christianity. But somewhere along by the end of the 18th century, it was discovered that slaves who were Christian slaves made better slaves. And one of the most enormous and one of the most constant features of the pitch that was given slaves as missionary activities accelerated among them, primarily by the Church of England, and the acceleration of missionary activities took place by the early 19th century, was that regardless of what your existence is on earth, if you do your duty to your masters, as it is ordained in the Bible and other scriptural teachings, you will be rewarded in the afterlife. And that afterlife then came to be a very eloquent promise to the slaves of something to be looked forward to. Now, this kind of belief existed within African society long before, okay? And it was a kind of belief that slaves had in centuries earlier when they came to the New World.
Jerry, what are some of the specifics of this belief in an afterlife? What, for instance, archaeologically?
Well, one specific thing that we learned, as we excavated about 100 skeletons out of this cemetery, and there was a real patterning in the way in which the skeletons were oriented. In the earliest periods, when we would have expected to find the most profound African beliefs, the skeletons were oriented on an east-west axis. And it became apparent to us that, or it seemed as if, there was an orientation towards the east, that is, towards Africa. And one day I was reading a historical account written by an English medical doctor who accompanied a British military expedition in the late 18th century into the West Indies. And he reported that while he was in Barbados, while his ship was being provisioned, he happened to encounter a black funeral and noticed after the funeral, women gathered around the grave. It was a woman who was buried. And they started putting on the grave various bits and pieces of food, and also started crying out to the woman who was buried, "Jenny, Jenny, Jenny, remember us when you get to the other side." And I started looking through my notes, puzzled about this was an African-born woman, as the doctor had reported, and the women who were lamenting may or may not have been African-born, but the woman who was buried was African. And I started looking through my notes and started to think about the orientation of these burials and found oftentimes the expression going to the other side. Well, normally we assume going to the other side means crossing from Greek mythology. I think it's the river Styx or whatever it may be. And it began to occur to me, putting this together with the African belief in the transmigration of the soul, and without going into great detail in this story, that what one had here by combining an archaeological interpretation or interpretation of our archaeological findings, the orientation of the bodies, with the kind of information we got out of the historical sources, that what was being meant, what was meant when we were talking about going to the other side, was the fact that after these African slaves died, their souls would migrate back to Africa and they would enjoy the kind of freedom in their native land they could not enjoy within the West Indies, in this particular case in Barbados. And then it struck me this was one of many, many features in which you could find how the condition of slavery itself affected and changed an African belief, though the belief was built fundamentally upon an African one. That is to say that after death, one soul migrated back to Africa, where one was free and enjoyed a life quite different than the one that one knew in the New World.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to part 5 in the Center's series of discussions on Afro-American culture, literature, and social order, seen from contemporary and historical perspectives. My guest was Jerome Handler of Southern Illinois University. Professor Handler recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about slave life on the West Indian island of Barbados between the 17th and 19th centuries. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part 5 in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. My guest is Jerome Handler of Southern Illinois University, whose book, entitled Africans and Their Descendants in Barbados, examines the social and cultural life of a West Indian slave population in the 200-year period spanning the early 17th through the early 19th centuries. How did the slaves of Barbados live? What cultural elements did they bring with them from Africa? How were these transformed in the New World? Afro-American Culture, Literature, and Social Order, Part 5 in a series, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.